In order all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels.
Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge,
all our steps on paths of omniscience,
may these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this.
So as we go through all these different presentations of Vipassana, I hope it's becoming clear that there's basically like three types of Vipassana that are being presented, or three options for what Vipassana is or could be. One is panoramic awareness, Trungpa Rinpoche's main presentation of Vipassana's panoramic awareness, although he presents different versions of that, which we're looking at. Then there's analytical Vipassana, which involves, has a range of activity going from very analytical or discursive, starting from outside of meditation, and involves all of the study or thought about the Dharma that you ever do, and then gradually gets more and more penetrating into what is the nature of reality, what is the nature of the self, and are those real? In what way are they not real? What does it mean that they're not real? And how does that relate to the fact that we still perceive them as if appearing? And that gets encapsulated in the different arguments of the Madhyamaka tradition for emptiness. And then it gets structured in the four stages of Vipassana: external, perceiver, percept, perceiver, the understanding of emptiness, and then completely letting go. And then there's resting Vipassana, or actual Vipassana, or transcendent Vipassana, which is the union of Shamatha Vipassana, the culmination of the discursive analytical Vipassana, brings it to its fruition in terms of being able to actually contemplate emptiness with a steadiness. In Trungpa Rinpoche, Trungpa Rinpoche refers to that today, where he says, he talks about the union of Shamatha and Vipassana briefly at one point, and either clearly or implying that the culmination of Vipassana is being able to do practice basically Shamatha on the understanding of Vipassana. Practicing Shamatha on the understanding of emptiness. So we get the intellectual understanding of emptiness until it becomes transcendent, or transcendental intellectual understanding, or transcendent knowledge, prajna. And then we do Shamatha on that. So those three types, with a range within each of depth or progression. But really those three types. And so the question becomes, when Trungpa Rinpoche presents panoramic awareness, what is he presenting? Is he presenting, is it just one of the aspects of Shamatha that he's highlighting, right? We talked about Shamatha as having three aspects: the intensity, the ardency that the Buddha presents in the fourfold, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra: ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful. So is panoramic awareness, or Vipassana in Rinpoche's general presentation, is it really that factor of clear comprehension, identified, isolated, and enhanced, using it as a bridge from shama to Vipassana? Or is it actually, when he's talking about panoramic awareness, is it, bless you guys, is it a subtle form of the analytical Vipassana? Is it a subtle form of experiencing the absence of finding a self? Or is it the culmination of the intellectual analytical Vipassana, where one goes through this analytical understanding of egolessness and emptiness and ends up in a place of panoramic awareness?
All of the above.
Or all of the above.
That's the space one, panoramic more, you think?
Yes, yeah, where does merging mind with space come in? What is that? Again, he refers to it today in today's reading again. It adds another nuance to it. So I was thinking that we should go through these readings starting with the portable stage set from The Path is the Goal, on page 131. And this book, The Path is the Goal, is two seminars that Rinpoche did, ostensibly on meditation, ostensibly on Vipassana, or insight meditation. It's sort of what it's known for in our tradition. It appears to me, in my humble opinion, that in the first one he gave a more thorough presentation, and then in the second one he sort of backed up and he did a similar thing to what he did in the progression of the seminaries, where initially he presented a more advanced version and then he backed up and presented a more progressive version. So I thought I would start with the more progressive version and then lead into the what appears to be more thorough and progress into more advanced versions. So on page 131 we have the portable stage set, which is a famous talk he gave, talking about how we work with the projection of our version of the world, starting with the version with our projection of ego in meditation, and how this type of meditation provokes us to both see that projection, as well as in some way to magnify it. It's like you become like hypersensitive to everything you do at a certain phase in meditation, in the path, where it's like all of a sudden you become like really aware of all the little activities, the karmic seeds and so forth that you do. So he says, we should probably discuss the various types of backgrounds with the help of which we operate in our lives. Psychological backgrounds, frameworks. These are vague, uncertain, dubious. I'm talking about the kind of background we create in our minds in every situation. When we enter somebody's room, when we sit by ourselves, when we meet someone. This kind of background is partially made up of a sense of basic space that we carry around with us all the time, and it's also colored by our particular mood of the moment. It's a kind of portable stage set that we carry around with us that enables us to operate as individuals. We constantly produce a display, a theatrical scene. For each situation, we create the appropriate backdrop and the appropriate lighting. We also have the appropriate actors, mainly ourselves, who appear on the stage. We carry on this kind of play, this theatrical game, all the time, and we're constantly using our antennae, so to speak, to feel out the total effect our stage set is having. And clearly we feel this more when we go into new situations, when we meet new people, we're put into foreign situations. You feel much more intensely that sort of
Self-consciousness,
yeah, thank you. In Vipassana meditation, we deal with this kind of background, our portable theater. Whether we're a big deal or a small deal, there's always some kind of deal happening. Vipassana works with that big deal or small deal, that great deal, large deal, littlest, expansive, cunning, or clever deal, whatever setup you have chosen to establish. In practicing Vipassana, instead of keeping very busy setting up your theater, your theatrical stage, your attitude has changed so that there's a sense of questioning how we produce this background, why we do it, whether we have to do it, or might not have to do it. This is still on the level of inquiry in some sense, but at the same time it's experimental. So there's a slight shift from our normal mode of operation of like of habitually cranking up our theater based on the situation, the dynamics of the situation. And there's just the slightest shift to some awareness that we're doing that, that we're acting a certain way, that we're presenting ourselves in a certain way when we meet people. And again, it's more dramatic when you're in new situations. And there's the self-consciousness that we develop from watching ourselves do that has a sense of spaciousness, of like looking at ourselves from this sort of larger perspective. Seeing ourselves say hello, introduce ourselves, interact, say things, what we're wearing, how we're moving, things like that.
So is the portable stage set, was that the same as a cocoon, would you say?
I think the cocoon is one type of stage set.
What would be another type of stage set?
Another type could be the robin's nest.
Okay.
Different environments, right? The, you know, I think the cocoon is like an extreme version of a confused, insular version of a stage set. I guess there's some, like when you say the cocoon, is there a presumption that we're all in the cocoon all the time until we're enlightened, or you know, are there versions of the cocoon?
Well, it's like when you said, when we start practicing and we start being aware of our stage set, which is like the way you presented Shambhala training, is that, you know, you begin slits in the cocoon, you begin to see it, you not really get out of it yet, but you're seeing yourself and how you have your shtick. So that's sort of like the practicing part, you're beginning to see through it, but you're still there with it.
And is the cocoon the way you present to the world?
The way you think of yourself and the way you present to the world.
I guess somehow for me the cocoon is more focused on how we sort of limit ourselves internally, psychologically. How we sort of miss the opportunity to wake up all the time and go back into a sort of familiar place of the stories that we tell ourselves.
Habitual patterns.
And the habitual patterns and stuff like that. And it doesn't have as much aeration quality of the portable stage set.
Okay.
I was going to say, this doesn't feel negative necessarily.
Yeah. It's an implicit negativity to it. And it feels to me like the cocoon is sort of like how we carry ourselves around within that stage set. Is that within that stage, you know, externally we project a certain, you know, friendliness or happiness or whatever, but internally we might be frozen or fearful or aggressive, and that sort of like the internal stage set is sort of the cocoon, it feels to me like.
Mm-hmm.
Or
okay.
Like your costume underneath your clothes, you know, it's like you have your outward costume and then underneath you have your long johns or whatever. You know, it's sort of like the stuff you're hiding. The more hidden level.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
In Vipassana, you as the practitioner experience the game that you're playing in setting up the theater. From that, you pick up a new way of dealing with the whole thing without it being a game. So it shifts the quality of the theater from being a game where you're sort of like trying to figure out how to act in a situation, what's going on, how to interact, and how to succeed. And it shifts it from that into a slightly different experience. This is the practice, sitting practice of meditation. When you sit, you don't sit for the sake of creating a further display or particular effect. It's a very private thing in some sense. In sitting practice, you relate to the radiation you are creating, that self-consciousness. The self-consciousness becomes conscious of how we project and how we appear. Before you begin sitting, this radiation was being created purely in order to impress or overpower the audience. In this case, however, the situation becomes reversed. You experience your own radiation face to face rather than playing with it in order to impress or overpower your audience. Since you have no audience when you sit and meditate, or you are your own audience, and therefore the dynamic of the usual scheme of trying to lay something over on our audience shifts, because we're just sitting there and like endlessly, it's like you sit down and like you because there's no audience, you start playing the presentation to yourself, and at some point you realize that like you're projecting your stage set to yourself, and it begins to get weird, embarrassing. Like, why am I still doing this? It's just me here.
Cut it out.
Right, it gets boring, endlessly repetitive. Even in this situation, however, it's possible for subtle little tricks to still take place. You congratulate yourself for sitting and being such a good boy or girl, and try to make that into a display. It's very subtle. The games can be peeled away one after the other like the layers of an onion. The game continues to happen, obviously, but somehow you can deal with this. And so the game is, in this case, is called what, in Rinpoche's famous terminology?
The games?
This particular game of being a good meditator. Spiritual materialism. You have had the basic training of shamatha practice, and from there you begin to expand. I'd like to stress again that the shamatha experience is extremely important. Without that foundation, the practitioner is not at all in a position to experience vipassana. But with that foundation, the practitioner can begin to expand the meaning of mindfulness so that it becomes awareness. So the subtle shift from the awareness of the breath, the posture, whether sitting or walking, and then the thoughts, the habitual patterns. So being aware of them gradually grows to the point where you notice the patterns, the stage set, the projection. Mindfulness is being fully there, and awareness is a total sensing. Fully there in terms of moment by moment specific precision. And then total sensing is the larger framework. And awareness, all happenings are seen at once. This could also be called panoramic vision. Panoramic vision in this case is having a sense of the entire radiation that we create. We possess a certain mannerism or certain style that is reflected outward. When you sit, this becomes purely a thought process. You develop a sense of appreciation of things around you, not one by one, but totally. It's like light radiating from a flame or a light bulb that expands outward. However, we find that this radiation has no radiator. So as you're there experiencing this endless habitual projection, at some point you begin to, the quality of like looking at the process has a sort of haunting quality, because you begin to realize that there's no creator, no owner of doing it. It's like, if I'm watching myself doing it, then who's doing it? Where is it coming from? And so it begins to have this experience of slight tinge or beginning stage experience of egolessness.
Couldn't it be multiple personalities?
Yeah, but that would, I think, dissolve at some point. If you look into who is doing all these tricks, producing this display, this radiation, there's nobody. Even the idea of somebody doesn't exist. There's a pure sense of openness. You relate with the living world as an open world, which doesn't mean that, like, all of a sudden the projection disappears. It just becomes like a sort of ownerless projection, and it sort of expands the framework where normally we have a boundary around, like, me and the rest of the world, and that sort of experience helps you to sort of see the interdependence of my projection, my habitual patterns in the world around me. At this point, we're only just introducing the Vipassana experience. We're just barely insinuating or touching upon it. Later we'll go into it in greater detail. What's necessary to understand now is that the Vipassana experience does not proceed to the level of a game, but remains purely at the level of experience, the living experience of awareness, as opposed to mindfulness. Awareness in this case is not awareness of self, but awareness of the other. The difference between the two is that you are aware of yourself. Sorry, if you are aware of yourself, it is awareness of yourself, being aware of yourself, aware of yourself, aware of yourself, aware of yourself. There's some kind of incest taking place. Whereas if you're just being aware, that is openness, a welcoming gesture. So it's like loosening up the grasping process. Like when you have that grasping process of trying to regain your ground or trying to achieve ground or pursue an agenda, then there's like this inward process of like watching what you're doing so that you can do it better and start by succeeding, and you're keeping track. Whereas if you come at this process through the practice of meditation, where basically through the shamatha experience we're dissolving or eroding our expectation. We start meditating expecting like we're going to get something, and gradually over time that expectation gets worn away, and it shifts this dynamic so that we're not like achieving anything, but instead relaxing into this process of awareness, as opposed to it being a sort of desperate activity.
So is this awareness what we talked about before is Shechen? Or is this
You tell me, yeah. I mean, all of this, is this Shechen in terms of clear comprehension, an aspect of shamatha, or is this Vipassana, is this insight, or what? I mean, does it say anything else? Whereas if you're just being aware, it's a welcoming gesture, openness, you include your doings within the realm of awareness, so you don't punish, or you don't watch, you don't question particularly, but you just be. That seems to be the basic approach or basic policy in insight meditation for Vipassana. So I skipped the Q&A. So yeah, that's the question. It's like in each of these versions of Vipassana, and we've collected all these different versions that are in all these different books, which are records of different seminars that he's given over time. He presents different, slightly different aspects of Vipassana, with different emphases or different slants, maybe different stages. And so where do they fit into what I described earlier as three types of Vipassana? I described three types of Vipassana. I said panoramic awareness, analytical Vipassana, or resting actual Vipassana, which is shamatha upon the understanding of emptiness. And I should have added that there's also the question arises of where is that quality of clear comprehension that is part of shamatha enter into that picture of Vipassana? How does that relate to panoramic awareness as he presents it? How does it link to the different types of Vipassana? And so as John is asking, you know, this seems like clear comprehension. This seems to me to be the part of shamatha, really. And, you know, the fact that he says we're just introducing the Vipassana experience sort of reveals that He's just sort of laying the ground. He's like creating the progression from shamatha as precision to shamatha as a wider experience, a wider perspective, a wider purview about our habitual patterns, our psychological makeup, which I think happens naturally as we go through the practice with the gap where we see our patterns, but the the gap on the in-breath sort of punctures our attempt to achieve and fight against our habitual patterns, and instead lets them become projected in like this sort of display quality. Any other thoughts on that?
It seems like maybe it's just that it's leading into becoming analytical, because I guess, is this just you watching, here's what it is, here's my habitual pattern? But then after a while, it's like you get bored watching and you kind of start picking at it a little bit. And then you realize, oh, this is kind of, what is this thing? And then that falls apart, and then you're kind of, so it kind of, it seems to me it naturally is all of the above, but they kind of
leads one into the other.
Yeah.
What about the part of who's aware of the awareness? That whole part of being aware of being aware of being aware of being aware. Is that Vipassana?
I don't think so. It feels like that's very focused. It's always being focused on back to yourself. It's like this inward.
That's mindfulness. Isn't it?
It's what?
Mindfulness, he said, isn't it?
No. I mean, mindfulness, that feels like is just being aware of it as being mindful of an object, which could be...
I think you meant shamatha.
I was thinking, because it's so repetitive, you can just be constantly aware that you would be sort of looking at yourself, looking at yourself, and just endlessly not separating from the whole game. You do need separation. I thought that was the thing. At some point, you realize that unless you separate from all the stuff going on, you're not going to be clear. So you have to almost force yourself to try to step back from the whole experience. And to do that, I suppose you do need to up your, you know, awareness of everything.
So if you do it right now, how do you do it?
What do you mean?
If you stop for a moment and like look at the projection.
You have to disown it, I think.
How do we automatically? I think we've all had experience in doing, seeing our projection, right? So what is the process? Is it like a grabbing onto what's happening inside, or is it like a stepping back? Or
it's stepping back.
It's thinking.
It's thinking. So it's like watching the thinking. Anyone else?
And then there's a cutting aspect to it. Just like, okay, because I'm aware of myself being aware of being myself of being aware.
What is it that you're cutting? Are you cutting the thoughts, or are you cutting something else?
Well, I think for myself that it becomes the thought, and that's what I'm cutting, rather than really being aware of it.
Well,
it's like a hamster wheel.
It's just this space, there's more space in there, so like that you see it, but you're not pushing it away, and you're not getting hooked on it.
Try it again. So we're all trying to figure out something. Watch yourself with your portable display of trying to figure something out. And I think it ranges from things like, you know, what's your posture? What are you wearing? What's your mood? Are you feeling sluggish or awake or cheerful or depressed? And then it goes from there. Bless you. So So is it a focusing in or is it an expanding out?
It's an expanding out.
It has to be.
Yeah.
The closer you get, you're like, that's not the way to go. Because, I'm already too close.
Yeah, I'm already like in each thought, thinking of something, right?
Yeah.
And so that's my limited perspective. So the only way to watch what I'm doing is to sort of step back, So when you say cutting, I feel like it's cutting the watcher to some extent. It's cutting the keeping track function. And it's like releasing the momentum and seeing the momentum. Instead of being in the momentum, it's like letting that momentum go.
Seems like fascination too.
Yeah, well, that's the keeping track. Yeah.
It's like, no, just let it go.
Okay, well, let's see his next talk in this seminar. So, 133. One of the points of basic Vipassana practice is to develop what is known as the knowledge of egolessness. That is to say, the awareness that develops through the Vipassana experience brings non-existence of yourself. And because you develop an understanding of the non-existence of yourself, therefore you're freer to relate to the phenomenal world, the climate, atmosphere, or environment we've been talking about. There's nothing in the way. One of the other places we'll get to, he says, you're not keeping track of two things all the time anymore, me and some situation or object. Unless there's no basic center, one cannot develop the Vipassana experience. Letting go of the center is the requirement. On the practical level, this means that Vipassana is experiencing a sense of the environment, a sense of space, as the meditator practices. This is called awareness as opposed to mindfulness. Mindfulness is very detailed and direct, but awareness is something panoramic, open. Even in following the breathing techniques of mindfulness and breathing, you're aware not only of the breathing, but also of the environment you have created around the breath. So, initially we like follow the instructions, feel the breath, identify with the breath, feel the texture of it, the temperature, maybe hear it, feel it against the nostrils going out. And then gradually as we go out and experience over and over again the dissolving and the letting go and the out-breath, we get more comfortable in that area of no object. Initially, the area of no object is a big problem for people. Like, whenever you teach meditation at first, everybody's like, what do I do on the in-breath? It just doesn't make any sense. The mind has to have an object. And so it cranks up thoughts, whatever. And as you sort of struggle with the natural activity of the mind, of having to think about something, that continues that pattern if you struggle with it. But as you gradually like relax into the acceptance that your mind is going to do that on the in-breath and to some extent on the out-breath, then it changes the tenor of it. You're no longer like captured by it, but you've shifted to some larger framework, like what we just did when we're looking at our stage set. As far as dealing with heavy-handed thoughts and emotions is concerned, there's no way of destroying or getting over them unless you see the reference point there that is with them. The reference point that is with them. To begin with, seeing this takes the form of awareness of the atmosphere of the environment. If you are already aware of the atmosphere beforehand, then there's a possibility that you might have a less intense relationship with your heavy-handed thoughts. That's one of the basic points. So if you're aware of your general like irritability, then when it crescendo gets caught by something that happens that bothers you, you might be more apt to not get fully caught. Because you have a sense that, oh, I had this ground of irritability there anyway, and so now I've just latched on to something. you know, or if you have a poverty mentality of like, or if you're really hungry, you know, or really tired, and that's the framework, then it colors the specific experiences. And so it gives you a little bit of distance from the usual sense of being captured by emotion that happens, because you're coming sort of from the outside instead of the inside. Once you're aware of the atmosphere, you begin to realize that thoughts are no big deal. That's a bit of a stretch, huh?
Well, it's sort of what you were saying.
It is, yeah. But in reality, it's always difficult, right? Thoughts can just be allowed to diffuse into the atmosphere. This kind of atmosphere that we're talking about is, in any case, an ongoing experience that happens to us in our lives. But sometimes we find that we are so wrapped up in our little game, our little manipulation, that we miss the totality. That is why it is necessary for students to begin with shamatha, so that they can see the details of such an eruption, such a manipulation, the details of the game that goes on. Then beyond that, having established some kind of relationship with that already, they begin to see the basic totality. Thus, Vipassana's understanding the whole thing. And this reminds me, by the way, of like meeting Rinpoche or other advanced teachers like him. Basically, what they do when you meet them personally is they are in this much larger space, like all the time, and they sort of pull you out of your little fixation. And it's like a magnet or something, and they just sort of magnetize you out. It's like they show you this larger perspective, and you can either relax and go with that, or you can try to fight it and like want to hold on to your storyline or your some important thing that you want to achieve or talk to them about or get, or some problem that you have, and you can fight that, and then it like gets worse because you feel like it begins to feel like you're being belittled by that space, you know?
Like ignored.
Ignored or made fun of. Or. But sometimes we find we're so wrapped up that we miss the totality. Thus, Vipassana's understanding the whole thing. You might ask, what is this whole thing, Rinpoche? Well, it's not particularly anything, really. This whole thing is the accommodator. I like that. The accommodator of all the activities that we're talking, that are taking place. It's the basic accommodation, which usually comes in the form of boredom, as far as the practitioner is concerned. The practitioner is looking for something to fill the gap, particularly in the sitting practice of Vipassana meditation, where the quality of non-happening becomes very boring. And then you might get agitated by the boredom, which is the way of filling it up with some activities.
It's like the alaya. There's not enough. The subconscious.
Well, I think it's the interplay between the alaya and the alaya vijna. And I keep remembering like what Rinpoche did to help you experience this. It's like you would come into the room with him, and often he did it with smoking. He would smoke cigarettes, I think, intentionally to do things. And it would produce this spacious feeling in the room where of like timeless boredom, of him just very patiently smoking. Instead of like a lot of people when they smoke, you know, they pull in, and you can see like the need for the nicotine, right? It's like they're being used to them. And he was just so relaxed about it, and people would be talking and presenting their this and that, and he would just be sitting there listening, and it's like it was like he was like this enlightened creature that you would like plug in and like an ion machine or something, right? And it would like suck all the energy out of the confused people in the room and disperse it.
A character in the Alice in Wonderland that sort of has that quality of just
Cheshire
Cat. Is it that one? Somehow that when you were describing that, it made me think of some one of those characters that just.
That's cool. Yeah. Just sits there smiling and.
Kind of taunts you.
Yeah.
But he didn't taunt us. He wasn't that direct.
Sometimes.
No, but the Cheshire Cat, it was similar quality, I think.
I think so.
Yeah. Or the grin.
Yeah, the grin is right. Right?
Yeah. So in this case, the background is boredom. There are different types of boredom. Insecurity, lack of excitement, being idle, nothing happening. In this case, in Vipassana, the boredom we're talking about is a sense of being idle. This is unconditional boredom. The experience of Vipassana awareness has a quality of all-pervasive, thick, freeing. So space becomes like tangible. Or the atmosphere becomes tangible because you're much more, you become aware of the atmosphere more. And I think gradually, as you maybe connect to this, you're able to experience different people's energies in a more tangible way. Because like the environment that they bring, their portable stage set becomes more tangible. It has body at the same time it is fluid and somewhat challenging. Therefore, one's development awareness is taking place. One doesn't become spaced out particularly. Not at all. When we talk about being spaced out, we are talking about being empty-hearted. It's a really interesting difference, right? When we sort of give up, and we like lose track or lose contact. When we're empty-hearted, then the dazzling light of emotions begins to irritate us. We can't grasp anything and we're ready to completely freak out. Whereas the Vipassana awareness is something much more tangible in some sense than this heavy and this empty-heartedness. It is something very personal that exists. It usually accompanies any kind of activity, not only in sitting practice alone. For example, sitting and listening to this talk, you have developed or created a certain type of attitude. You're directing your attention toward the speaker, but also you know at the same time that you and the speaker are not the only people in this tent. So there's the sense that you're sitting in the middle of the inside of the space, underneath the ocean, so to speak. And awareness brings about you relating with that particular experience, which is tangible, real, experiential. When awareness relates to that type of experience, it's called insight. So what does it mean by the ocean?
Sounds like the Alia, no?
Yeah, I think in some sense.
When they say ocean, right? That's the code word.
Yeah, Alia Vajnana, actually.
Alia Vajnana. The subconscious, which is what Freud would call it, right?
Somewhat, yeah. Well, it's similar to that, right? But I don't know, anyone else the ocean?
I was thinking it was more simple, that somehow he was just creating the atmosphere of we're in this
tent.
Space, the tent, whatever, but he was just kind of getting a little bit, I mean, you know, obviously he's pulling it out a little bit by making it, you know, a natural analogy or something. But I didn't think it was... I think that was just, I don't know, I was thinking that was just a little bit more of a...
Not that significant, yeah. Anyone else? Ocean? I don't know, think about it. When awareness relates to that type of experience, it's called insight. Sometimes this is spoken of in terms of light or luminosity. But this doesn't mean something fluorescent. It refers to the sense of clarity that exists in this experience, which is a really important point. I've said this a number of times, that luminosity doesn't mean light like that. It's not like that is more luminous than the darkness over here. The luminosity has to do with your awareness, your cognition, your cognitive vividness. So sometimes in darkness, it's even more, the luminosity is greater because you're trying to be more aware because there's not enough light. So you become sharp, your awareness becomes sharper, projects, radiates more. Once you feel that basic all-pervasiveness, then there's nothing else but that, the other, and this, oneself, is long forgone. So there's a shift of emphasis. Maybe at the beginning this tried to struggle to fight with that, the all-pervasiveness, but though this might struggle, at some point the all-pervasiveness is all over the place, by definition. And a sense of suffocation begins to develop. And that subtle suffocation turns into boredom. Psychological experience of shifting from our normal mode of mental operation, of fixation on our habitual patterns. And then this other stuff begins to happen. When the reference point gets dissolved, then we experience this greater atmosphere. There's more of an awareness of the other, the outside, the accommodation, the accommodator, the all-pervasiveness, the ocean. And it begins to have a somewhat oppressive quality. What is it that feel, what part of you feels oppressed by it? Does he use the word suffocation?
I'm saying it's mind.
The mind is trying to keep track still, the old habitual pattern that's there, like what's going on, who am I, what should I be doing, where am I going? That begins to feel suffocated, oppressed.
I was also thinking when you go back to that ocean thing that on some level, because he was talking about, you know, you're in the room, there's the speaker, so you're basically in this context where teachings are being given. So I was also thinking it's almost like the ocean of Dharma is also like you're in the midst of there too. I mean, it's sort of this pervasive feeling of not just physical presence, but what's going on. You know, there's some kind of, you know, I think the ocean introduces the sense of almost thickness of the atmosphere, you know. Sometimes in teachings that kind of thing does occur, where it doesn't feel just ordinary.
The thickness now you're talking about, definitely, that's like what I was talking about with Rinpoche, like, magnetizing the neurosis out of people by making the external atmosphere thicker, more palpable. And Rinpoche was a master of this when he would give public talks and teachings, just like projecting this electrical energy is like maybe the most conventional way to describe it. This is just the beginning stage of Vipassana, again, that we've been describing. So again, I think going back to what John said, that sense of the growth, the development of that quality of clear seeing, clear knowing, as one of the qualities really of shamatha. That quality being the bridge from shamatha to Vipassana. I would like to emphasize once more that we're not talking about hypothetical possibilities. You can actually experience this in your life, in your being. And in fact, potentialities of Vipassana are already prominent in experience. They take place all the time. But we have not actually acknowledged them, or perhaps even seen them. Okay, so now let's go back to this talk that's titled, has this really bizarre title, Continuing Your Confusion. Groundwork regarding the practice of meditation. Now we can go further and discuss the point that the practice of meditation involves a basic sense of continuity. The practice of meditation does not involve discontinuing one's relationship with oneself and looking for a better person or search for possibilities of reforming oneself or and becoming a better person. So there's this tendency to think that meditation is severing the continuum of the person, that the confused, ignorant person I am, messed up person, and replacing it with some better, meditative, more enlightened person. The practice of meditation is a way of continuing one's confusion, of actually releasing your confusion in meditation practice, letting your confusion come out. Normally we control it, we restrain our confusion, we manage it. And meditation practice, it comes out because we've started to accept it and let it unfold. Chaos, aggression, and passion. But working with it, not just letting it go wild. We're working with it. And we're working with it by seeing it from the enlightened point of view. And in this case, seeing it from the enlightened point of view means seeing it from the larger atmosphere perspective. That is the basic purpose of meditation practice as far as this approach is concerned. It's certainly a different view of meditation than the popular. There's a Sanskrit term for meditation, shamatha, which means development of peace. In this case, peace refers to the harmony connected with accuracy, rather than to peace from the point of view of pleasure, rather than pain. So again, normally peace means, oh, everything's been, all pain has subsided, all neurosis, confusion, unrest has subsided, and now we're experiencing peace. But peace in the sense of harmony, where we're not like divided from what's going on in our mind by fighting against it, or struggling against it, or wanting to change or fix it, but just by virtue of being precisely attentive to every detail of our mental experience, we become in sync with it. And that whole idea of synchronizing mind and body, synchronizing awareness really and mental activity, leads to a sense of peace, even if it's going through its habitual patterns.
So it's making peace with what we're feeling, even though we don't want to feel it.
Even though we might not like it.
Accepting it, making peace with that's what's going on with me right now, rather than saying, I don't want to feel this, I hate this.
Meditation's not working. And
right, I shouldn't be feeling this.
Yeah, my mind is fucked up. We have experienced pain, discomfort, because we failed to relate with the harmony of things as they are. We haven't seen things as they are precisely, directly, properly. And because of that, we have experienced pain, chaotic pain. But in this case, when we talk about peace, we mean that for the first time, we're able to see ourselves completely, perfectly, beautifully, as what we are, absolutely as what we are. I'm going to skip that next paragraph and go to the one after it. Shamatha meditation practice is the vanguard practice for developing our mindfulness. I would like to call your attention to this term, mindfulness. Generally, when we talk about mindfulness, it has to do with a warning sign, like a label on your cigarette package where the Surgeon General tells you this is dangerous to your health. Be aware of this. Be mindful of this. But here, mindfulness is not connected with a warning. In fact, it is regarded as more of a welcoming gesture. You could be fully minded, mindful. Mindfulness means that you could be a wholesome person, a completely wholesome person, rather than that you should not be doing this or that. Mindfulness here does not mean that you should look this way or that way so you can be cured of your infamous problems. Whatever they are, your problems of being mindless. Maybe you think like this, you're a highly distracted person, you have problems with your attention span. You can't sit still for 5 minutes or even 1 minute, you should control yourself. Everybody who practices meditation begins as a naughty boy or naughty girl who has to learn to control himself or herself. They should learn to pay attention to their desk, their notebook, their teacher's blackboard. That is the usual attitude that is usually connected with the idea of mindfulness. But this approach here has nothing to do with going back to school, and mindfulness has nothing to do with your attention span as you experience it in school at all. This is an entirely new angle, a new approach of development of peace, harmony, and openness. The practice of meditation in the form of shamatha at the beginner's level is simply being. Practice of meditation, the form of shamatha at the beginner's level, is simply being. It is a bare attention that has nothing to do with a warning. It's just simply being and keeping a watchful eye completely and properly. There are traditional disciplines, techniques for that, mindfulness techniques, but it's very difficult actually to explain the nature of mindfulness. When you begin trying to develop mindfulness in the ordinary sense, a novice sense, your first flash of thought is that you're unable to do such a thing. You feel that you might not be able to accomplish what you want to do. You feel threatened. And at the same time, you feel very romantic. I'm getting into this new discipline, which is a unique and very powerful thing for me to do. I feel joyous, contemplative, monkish.
Or nunkish.
Nunkish. I feel a sense of renunciation, which is very romantic. Then the actual practice begins. The instructor tells you how to handle your mind and body and your awareness and so on. And practicing shamatha under those circumstances, you feel like a heavily loaded pack donkey trying to struggle across a highly polished stream of ice. You can't grip it with your hooves. And you have a heavy load on your back. At the same time, people are hitting you from behind. You feel so inadequate and embarrassed. Every beginning meditator feels like an adolescent donkey, heavily loaded and not knowing how to deal with the slippery ice. Even when you're introduced to various mindfulness techniques that are supposed to help you, you still feel the same thing, that you are dealing with a foreign element which you're unable to deal with properly. And you see this when you introduce people to meditation. Do you still do the intros here? So you see this, right? It's like people... We all go through this where we're like trying to do it and trying to figure out if we're doing it, like what is it we're trying to do, and it feels like we're trying to something's like foreign is being like imposed. We're trying to impose some foreign thing onto our state of being, and it feels awkward. But you feel that you should at least show your faith and bravery, that you're willing to go through the ordeal of the training, the challenge of the discipline. I got to try doing this. My spouse told me I had to do this, otherwise I'd be in trouble. The problem here is not so much that you're uncertain how to practice meditation, but that you haven't identified the teachings as your personal experience. So you haven't identified the innate potential for wakefulness. That's in here, as opposed to something that is going to be created within you by applying this special technique. The teachings are still regarded as a foreign element coming into your system. You feel you have to do your best with that sense of foreignness, which makes you a clumsy young donkey. The young donkey is being hassled by his master a great deal, and he's already used to carrying a heavy load and being hit every time there's a hesitation. In that picture, the master becomes external entity rather than the donkey's own conviction. A lot of the problems that come up in the practice of meditation have to do with a fear of foreignness, a sense that you are unable to relate with the teachings as part of your basic being. That becomes an enormous problem. The practice of shamatha meditation is one of the most basic practices for becoming a good Buddhist, a well-trained person. Without it, you cannot take even a step toward a personal understanding of the truth. Buddha Dharma, that Buddha Dharma is no myth. We know that this practice and technique was devised by the Buddha and that he went through the same process, therefore we can follow his example. Okay, so the basic technique here is identification with one's breath. When doing walking meditation, identification with one's walk. So here's the basic shamatha practice. The Buddha told a musician he should practice by keeping his mind not too tight and not too loose. The right amount of attention. So here, so as we practice the technique, we put 25% of our attention on the breathing, or the walking, the object. Only 25% on the object. The rest of our mental activities should be left loose, left open. This has nothing to do with the Vajrayana or crazy wisdom or anything like that. It's just practical advice when you tell somebody, keep a high level of concentration, to concentrate 100% and not make a mistake. The person becomes stupid and is liable to make more mistakes because he's so concentrated in what he's doing. There's no gap, there's no room to open oneself, no room to relay with the back and forth play between our reference point towards the object and the reference point of the subject. So the Buddha advised that you put only tentative attention on your technique, not make a big deal out of concentration on the technique. And he says, this method is mentioned in the Samadhi Raja Sutra. Concentrating too heavily on the technique brings all kinds of mental activities, frustrations, and sexual and aggressive fantasies of all kinds. So if you keep just on the verge of your technique, which is 25% of your attention, another 25% is relaxing. A further 25% relates to making friends with oneself, accepting. And the last 25% connects with expectation. Your mind is open to the possibility of something happening during this practice session. The whole thing is synchronized completely. So here, this interesting play on the expectation quality, where in one hand he's saying 25% connects with expectation, and your mind is open to the possibility of something happening during the practice session. How does that differ from the wearing away of the expectation process that happens in shamatha? Is that contradictory to this, to what I presented as the eroding of the expectation?
It's a natural eroding. You're not forcing.
Is he saying encouraging the expectation?
Letting expect.
In the same way that he's saying, cultivate 25% of attention and relaxation and making friends, like cultivating making friends with yourself. That you would think he's saying, like, actually cultivate that. Is he saying cultivate expectation?
It's more aware.
It says connects with expectation being open.
He gives it a different word. He calls it expectation.
Yeah.
So the ideal number of wheels in the middle of the next paragraph that we should have on our chariot is four, the four techniques of meditation: concentration, openness, awareness, and expectation.
Four foundations?
Not the four foundations of mindfulness. These are his version of four qualities that come up in either the middle of the path of accumulation or the greater path of accumulation. The greater path of accumulation is the four miraculous feet. And the middle part of the path of accumulation is the four right endeavors, letting go of negativity that we have, 40 negative patterns that we have, not giving rise to future negative patterns, cultivating positive patterns that we don't have, that we currently have, and giving rise to new ones. But it's also, some schemes add these four qualities, which seems to be what he's talking about. And it's unclear exactly what the terms are that he's getting at in his translations of them.
And he says that there are the four techniques.
Right.
Concentration, openness, awareness, and expectation.
Where he just put down concentration a little while ago.
I wonder if the feeling I got when you asked the question about expectation, because first I was sort of saying, no, that doesn't make sense. You know, I'm not supposed to do that. But then the feeling I had was that perhaps it, as we settle down and have done some practice, that there can be a quality of it that has less grasping. That in their initial practice, we're aiming for a goal, probably, whether it's getting enlightened or finding peace or calm or whatever it might be, you have some idea of where you're trying to get to, and it's somewhere. It seems like this kind of expectation is a little bit different. It's more like just staying open and uplifted to just general potential, as opposed to some specific goal.
That's what it seems like to me, where the expectation I talked about is eroding, is the preconceived expectation of this is what's supposed to happen, I want to achieve something. Whereas this is like this, an expectation as a, of a sort of opening quality, of like anticipation of like, well, what is this all about? A curiosity, Barbara.
Well, it's like a less fixed thing. Like you're more open to the possibility,
right?
In just in the moment, in that, like when you're really coming down on yourself, it's like you there's no possibility. You're stuck with yourself forever. In that,
it perpetuates that framework.
That, yeah, because then you get defensive, because if it's true, if what you think is true about yourself, then that's just hell. And so you want to make excuses to diminish it, but if you don't see it as all that serious in a way, and then you can just be open to the flow of what might happen. I don't know if that made any sense.
It did to me. Yeah, thanks.
And I think you also asked about one of the four was concentration, which formerly was sort of downplayed. So again, I guess the question there is whether it's in the context of this wider, broader, more open sort of situation, then some degree of concentration is okay. Just it's not that sort of fixated too much. It's not the idea of using the concentration heavily. Less heavy-handed, maybe.
Yeah. So it's trying to link them up with the first time you went through them, on the bottom on the left-hand side. So you keep just on the verge of your technique with 25% of your attention. That seems to be the concentration.
Right. Right.
The other 25% is relaxation. Openness, maybe?
Right.
The further 25 relates to making friends with yourself. What is that?
Maitri? I don't know.
Is that the openness?
Yeah.
Well, and the relaxation was awareness?
Yeah, we could switch it around that way.
He wasn't always the most precise guy in the world.
Yeah, well, right.
We're just not subtle.
We're consistent.
We're consistent. And the last 25 connects with expectation, which seems to be consistent.
I mean, you could see, in that sense, the relaxing, relaxing is sort of what enables awareness.
Yeah.
And in a sense,
accepting myself as openness. That's what
oneself,
I thought.
Yeah, I think
that those two get flipped.
It does seem to work better.
The reason why the technique is very simple is that way we cannot elaborate in our spiritual materialism trip. Skipping a few sentences, he says, in the case of breathing, it's a particular tradition that's developed from a commentary on the Samadhi Raja Sutra written by Gampo, where we find the notion related to breathing, mixing mind and space, which is also used in tantric meditative practices. But even at the Hinayana level, there's a mixing of mind and space. This has become one of the very important techniques of meditation. Sometimes this particular approach is also referred to as Shilak Songjuk, which is a Tibetan expression meaning combining shamatha and vipassana meditation practices. So here he affiliates all of a sudden mixing mind with space with the union of shamatha and vipassana. Now, earlier when we studied it, we looked at it, it was in the Profound Treasury, it was put in the shamatha section of the meditation chapter. And possibly the reason was that he presents it in this talk that's basically on shamatha, where he's going through the first foundation of mindfulness. And in the course of that talk, he presents this notion of mixing mind with space. But it's not really clear at that point where that practice comes in the scheme of shamatha, vipassana, and the union. Now he's saying maybe it's the union. So mixing mind with space as being the union of shamatha vipassana. Keep that possibility in mind as we explore further. What is the union of shamatha vipassana as opposed to vipassana itself? Like what, if the progression is from shamatha vipassana, this shamatha vipassana going backwards, you know, regressing? In what sense is it a further progression?
It's not, it's, I guess, integrating the set of the calmness and the steadiness that, because it's, I think, if you just do completely vipassana, it's, or like in analytic vipassana, for example, you can get into a very, you can get more discursive or more.
This is our general understanding, but see how he presents it and see how it relates to the mixing of mind and space. Combining them plays an important part in the meditator's development. Mindfulness becomes awareness. Mindfulness is taking an interest and precision of all kinds in the simplicity of the breath, of walking, of the sensations of the body, of the experiences of the mind, of the thought process and memories of all kinds. Awareness is acknowledging the totality of the whole thing. In the Buddhist tradition, awareness has been described as the first experience of egolessness. So all of a sudden we shift from awareness as panoramic awareness, totality, to analytical type of vipassana, the insight into egolessness. The term for awareness in Tibetan is lakthong. There's an expression, lakthong takme tokpe share, which means the knowledge that realizes egolessness through awareness. This is the first introduction to the understanding of egolessness. Awareness in this case is totality rather than one-sidedness. So again, think to yourself, in what sense does that panoramic quality of awareness relate to the understanding of egolessness, particularly in the way that he's now describing it? A person who has achieved awareness or who is working on the discipline of awareness has no direction, no bias in one direction or another. And this doesn't mean that you don't like know where north is, or you like how to, you know, get downtown versus uptown, or so forth. But clearly, it means more of like an ongoing agenda or a preconceived notion of situations. One is just simply aware, totally and completely, and this awareness also includes precision, which is the main quality of awareness in the early stage of the practice of meditation. Oh my God, did he just like confuse everything there? Precision, mindfulness, awareness now, it's the main quality of awareness. I thought it was the main quality.
Maybe it's a conscious trying to have no direction or bias.
And awareness in the early stage of meditation practice. And now, I think it's also helpful to know that he's constantly interpreting and making accessible the traditions that he's inherited of shamatha vipassana, of Buddhism in its entirety. Whenever he's presenting, he's distilling, he's making it experiential and accessible and simplifying it for us. And so, you know, we've read Kamala Shila, we've read Dzogchen Khyentse, all these traditional presentations of shamatha vipassana, and the four foundations of mindfulness sutra, and I didn't actually give you a good traditional presentation of the different qualities of mindfulness as being the different qualities of shamatha as being as consisting primarily of mindfulness and clear comprehension. I should give you that, but that's sort of that's like a given in the tradition. That's the background of the tradition, that shamatha has those qualities, primarily those two qualities of mindfulness and clear comprehension. So he's playing with it and how to like present it in a palatable way. Awareness brings egolessness because there's no object of awareness. You're aware of the whole thing completely, of you and other, and of the activities of you and other at the same time. So everything is open. You're aware of, aware of, aware of, aware. There's no particular object of the awareness, so there's no radiator. If you're smart enough, you might ask the question, who's being aware of the whole thing? That's a very interesting question, the $64 question. He's getting low budget here, right? It's usually 64,000. And the answer is nobody's being aware of anything but itself. The razor blade cuts itself. The sun shines by itself, fire burns by itself, water flows by itself, nobody watches, and that is the very primitive logic of egolessness, is that things happen without any owner, without an agent behind them. And then he's acknowledging that in the Mahayana Madhyamaka tradition of analyzing reality into emptiness, there's constantly used this analogy that light doesn't illuminate itself, a sword doesn't cut itself, fire does not burn itself. And he says, that's not what I'm talking about here. You know, so I'm sure the Mahayanists would sneer and think that is terrible logic, very crude. Because he's presented like that there's like some entity, is what the Mahayanists critique when they talk about emptiness, the sword cutting itself, fire burning itself. If you say that, it implies that there's an entity there. But he's using it experientially so that he's not like saying, philosophically speaking, there is an entity.
You know, when you asked earlier, he raised the question of what is, before we got into the Buddha section, what is the whole, understanding the whole thing, and then what is the whole thing that's really nothing. So I feel like that's coming back to this in a way too, that it's not like there's a, that there's really nothing to hold on to in this, and awareness as well, you know, you're always looking for solidifying it, but it's kind of de-solidifying it, you can't. There's no it, even though it calls it itself, it's sort of going beyond that notion of a thing.
Cousin it. So he says at the end of that paragraph, this is the egolessness of Vipassana practice. And awareness here does not mean that the person practices Vipassana meditation, gives up his or her shamatha techniques of the breath or walking. Hold on a second. The meditator simply relates with that discipline in a more expansive way. One begins to relate with the whole thing. And this is done in what's connection with what is known as the four foundations of mindfulness: body, mind, livelihood, and effort. So he totally messed up his own order. Right? Normally the order that he does is body, livelihood, effort, and mind. I think the idea is that the experience of relating to things in a more expansive way happens within certain domains. Sometimes people translate the four foundations of mindfulness as domains, that it's four domains where we apply mindfulness, or where we experience mindfulness and awareness: the domain of our body, of our feelings, or of our life force, of our effort or mind, and so forth. And so they become progressively larger domains, where our most tangible experience as human beings is our body. And then the next level of, the first level of subtlety is sensation, and so forth. The energetic quality of mind, and then the content of mind. So I'm going to skip that and go into the Q&A where somebody says, you characterize shamatha as mindfulness and vipassana as awareness. Then you went on to speak of a combination. How would you characterize that? It's a combination of the two, being precise and at the same time being open. Precision is shamatha and openness is vipassana. It's possible to have both of those happening together, as Cynthia was saying. It's combining those two. And so there's a little bit of a presumption that as you go from shamatha to vipassana, your shamatha declines somewhat. And as your vipassana gets stronger, it gets more shamatha-like, until your vipassana has the same quality of stability that your shamatha has. And he's, the next answer, he says, basically, shamatha and vipassana go through the entire path, as we saw from all those different excerpts in the Profound Treasury, where it goes all the way up through until the four yogas of Mahamudra. And I think skip the rest of the Q&A and we'll go to, unless anybody found something really something exciting to note in the Q&A, anything? Otherwise we'll go to panoramic awareness. Anything in the Q&A going once, twice? So 146. Let's see. He starts out talking about positive thinking. And gradually he weaves it into this notion of Buddha nature. That Buddha nature is like ultimate positive thinking. That there's two types of positive thinking. One is positive thinking that's dualistic, in the sense of thinking that's positive as opposed to negative, and then ultimate positive thinking is there is no negativity. Everything is inherently positive in that it has the potential for wakefulness, i.e. that is Buddha nature.
Is that wishlessness, by the way?
I guess so. That sounds, that would make sense. So then on the next page, 147, the first full paragraph, he says, this kind of positive vision, trying to push away the negative, and even perceiving the negative is a vision of the positive, because you come at the negative from the, from that realm of Buddha nature, with that point of view. And that's why we speak of panoramic awareness, which is positive thinking, which is Buddha nature. Relating with panoramic awareness could be said to be a way of freeing ourselves from the chain reaction of karma, which is based on hope and fear. As we discuss, karma is a chain reaction that's based on panic or uncertainty on the one hand, or also a chain reaction of goodness in a smaller one-sided sense of good versus bad. So, also presenting panoramic awareness as the method for cutting the chain of karma, which is also how egolessness is described. That seeing egolessness is what dismantles the karmic chain. So panoramic awareness in its sense of being the basis for experiencing egolessness or the essence of it also is the way to chip away the karmic chain reaction. In the next paragraph, in the middle, he says, panoramic awareness is Buddha nature. Never saw that before in any of his presentations of panoramic awareness. This is a very fruitional version. Right? Next page, third full paragraph. Being in an egoless state sharpens your intelligence because there's nothing in the way. You don't have to manage two things at the same time anymore. There's always just one thing to deal with. That's why it's called non-duality.
A panoramic, when you think of panoramic camera, you think of huge, sort of...
large.
Yeah.
View, right?
The left, the right, the top, the bottom.
Yeah, that sort of
opposite of like focus.
Yeah, diminishes the focal point, right? Me. And he touches on this briefly, a little bit on this notion of how do we sharpen prajna, how do we cultivate prajna. And the normal methodology or approach, conventional approach to developing wisdom is to sort of refine our mind, refine our understanding, with more and more subtle objects, more and more subtle concepts. And to some extent, one needs that, but to really sharpen our intelligence, in the sense of prajna, is by experiencing not finding any object. And isn't there a phrase in the letter of the Ashe, or the in the Sacred Path of the Warrior, where he says, "How does the warrior sharpen his sword or something on space or something like that?"
He says, "Not that you don't sharpen the sword.
Right.
It will only make it dull."
Right.
And then on the bottom right, the last paragraph, bless you, interesting comments on egolessness. We hear so much about the egoless state, but then when we experience it, we might feel doubt. There must be something more than that, than this. It's said that the secret of mind seems too easy to be true. Egolessness doesn't mean thoughtlessness, a state without thoughts. There will be thought patterns anyway. For instance, when you read sutras, there's prose in them that you can follow. They contain thought patterns of the Buddha, how he views things, how he thinks, how he presents a situation. Skipping the next sentence, he says, even then, two sentences. So of course there can be thought patterns without ego. As we read descriptions of enlightenment, it sounds very dramatic and glorious, but actually we experience a glimpse of it. It doesn't seem to be as glorious as the descriptions. The descriptions make us expect too much. And then this whole notion that once you glimpse panoramic awareness, it sort of emerges on its own. And we basically go through this process of thinking that we can cultivate it or increase it, which doesn't really work. And so gradually realizing that the conventional approach of trying to increase something that we want, in this case panoramic awareness, has goes the opposite direction, and instead we have to sort of relax and let it come to us, let it grow towards us. Once panoramic awareness is there, it grows, or rather it is gradually uncovered. Skipping a few sentences toward the end, he says, once the space is there already, you don't have to do anything with it. You just go along with the action. It's self-fulfillment. And that's why the notion of spontaneity comes in here. If you solidify the space, then that becomes the watcher, the abstract quality of your intelligence. And he talks about the negative aspects of the watcher. And at the end of that paragraph, the last few sentences, he says, so what one has to do is sort of undo everything. First of all, depersonalize the awareness of duality, and second, the natural duality should also be dissolved. It's a going backward process, an undoing process. On the right-hand page, in the first full paragraph, he says there's a subtle journey going from the shunyata level of recognizing the emptiness of our habitual patterns to the Mahamudra level, the attainment of Vajrayana vision, in which one is working directly with the energy of the situation. First of all, you perceive space and you're in the space but still conscious of it. Then in a certain stage, you lose even the notion of space. Sometimes you become heavily involved with that and you lose track of this altogether. That's just fascination taking over rather than a realization of egoless, like you get sucked into a movie or a TV show or a book or something. So you get heavily into that. And a lot of people say, is that like the same thing as meditation, where you're like totally dissolved into this other thing? And he says, the difference is that in the case of being one with the situation, there's no sense of being off balance, no sense of being on either side of that equation. So in the case of like getting sucked into a movie, it's like the balance is off. It's like you've given over completely there. And in the sense he's talking about, the larger vision, there's the balance of here and there, I guess.
Well, isn't it also that you're aware, you're slightly aware of physical? I mean, you're sucked into a movie, you're not aware of.
Right, you lose your awareness, yeah, like what time it is or something.
Well, you're not even aware, there's no awareness at all, you're just fixated on the movie.
Right.
There's studies where they say that after watching TV, people get depressed a little bit. So
get what?
Depressed a little bit.
So that's why people binge.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that's why people binge watch.
They keep watching.
Right, because once you turn off the TV, there's a certain loss of, like, whatever it was.
Yeah.
Now that's natural with, like, anything, right? TVs or computers.
Ice cream cones.
When it's finished, yeah.
People have their phones on all the time. Yeah. And when they turn them off, there's this big drop of energy. And then they turn them on, they go, there's your message. So they leave them on all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do people do that? Like when you wake up in the morning, you always have the radio or the TV on, right?
No.
I don't know if anyone does
people
that.
People walking around the streets, it's like, I mean.
Every once in a while, I go and stay with, like, I have a friend in Boulder, and his wife does that. Like, first thing in the morning, the TV is on. You go into the kitchen, it's like.
It's on all day long.
All day
it's
long.
It's like hospital, yeah. It's like a hospital, it's a hospital effect.
All day long.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's wallpaper. It's like
God. On the next page, 149, the end of that trailing paragraph. So the point is to acknowledge its presence. So we're talking about the panoramic awareness and how to cultivate it. Acknowledge its presence rather than try to suppress it. Oh, I'm sorry, irritation. Oh, he did this interesting thing on irritation. Did I miss that? I think he... Oh, here it's a lead-in. So how to deal with irritation. The last couple of sentences of that, on 149, the last couple of sentences of the the trailing paragraph from the page before. The point is to acknowledge its presence, it being irritation, rather than trying to suppress it. The approach is not analytical particularly, it's more instinctive. When we talk about relating with irritation here, we're talking about how to handle it at the beginning. When the first flash of irritation comes, just try to feel the abstract quality of it, the presence of it, and in that way you've set a proper balance from the start. So as opposed to, like, how do you deal with irritation as it continues? It's like, if you miss this initial step, it becomes very hard to, like, backtrack into a place where you're not taken over by the irritation. Then the irritation doesn't become overpowering. You don't become overpowering toward the irritation either. The next step is then dealing with the specific nature of the irritation. So it's like you wake up maybe and you're grumpy. I don't know, some people are sort of grumpy when they wake up. and then something comes at you, you know, bad news or the problem. And
or
if you're
a cheerful partner.
overly cheerful. upbeat person, and then and if you're not aware of your irritation, it's so easy to get sucked into fighting that, you know. But if you're, like, aware, oh God, I'm irritable, then it's like you don't get as sucked in. The next step is then dealing with the specific nature of the irritation. At this point, you've already set up the right relationship with irritation to allow you to handle it in a much easier way, as opposed to a confused way.
Doesn't this remind you of, like, waiting hours sometimes when Rinpoche is coming to talk? You go through these waves of irritation, then
it goes away.
It's like, oh, well, I'm here, and then it just comes back an hour ago.
Shit, you look at your watch, and you're like, on the right-hand side of the first paragraph, generally when irritation pops up, we automatically think we're obliged to do something with it without knowing what to do. However, we could work with it in the same way that we work with everything in meditation. It's the whole point of meditation. You can be doing nothing and still remain brilliant.
Only you know how much of a genius you are.
This takes away the fundamental speed connected with the irritation, which is not speed in any real sense anyway. It's like a rush hour. I love it. he's used this before, where we call rush hour as if you're rushing, but normally you're like stuck in traffic. So then skipping ahead, let's see.
Trying to rush hour.
On 150, the second full paragraph, he says, at the beginning of the path, ego may seem to be in control of the situation. In fact, the whole journey may start out as one gigantic, as a gigantic ego trip. The ego brings us to the Dharma by saying, gee, I'd like to get enlightened. And do all the stuff I've read about. We have to... We have to use that. You just begin where you are. It's a simple process. You start with ego's version of enlightenment. And at a certain stage, ego finds that it is threatened by your commitments to the path. And it begins to wear away, to drop out at that point. We're approaching the cliff we need to leap from, which is suicidal for ego. The ego cliff. There's actually a succession of sudden shocks until you fall after the last cliff. Whenever there's a cliff, ego tries to avoid it, tries to come back to a safer place by using the same logic constantly and not being willing to take any chances. At a certain point, ego begins to find that its aversion of enlightenment doesn't match the teachings, the genuine Dharma, but it ignores that. It creates its own version of the teachings. Whenever there's a cliff, it says, no, I'm not going over that cliff. I have something else to do today. I'm going to survive, so I'll make my own teaching that rationalizes my preservation of my ego. When a situation feels very uncomfortable, I would say there is more reason to approach the cliff than because there's some gap, some crack that has appeared. What is the crack in?
Awareness?
What's the
crack in the ego?
Crack in the ego, right? In that, in the solid
gap.
You know, in the cocoon, you know, in our weaving of our storyline, of our portable stage set, right? The lights aren't working, the curtains don't, I don't know, the set's not working.
It's interesting, it says, when neurosis is coming up more vividly, there is often a gap, that's it.
And so that's a great opportunity, thank you. So then on the next page, just to finish, sorry we're late a little bit,
when neuroses comes up more vividly, there's often a gap, so that's a great opportunity. So that concentration of neuroses, because you just because it's so dramatic to be so caught up in it that when you sort of let go, you can really see so clearly the difference. Is that?
Say it again. When the neurosis is so intense.
Right.
Your last sentence. When your neurosis is so intense.
So it's so built up, right? You've like totally bitten the hook, you're...
Yeah.
So then when you sort of flash awareness into it, the difference between that state, it just feels so artificial compared to the letting go of that.
Yeah, but the crack happens before you insert the awareness. The crack is the opportunity to insert the awareness. So where does the crack come in? When you have an intense emotional neurotic outburst, klesha attack, where does the crack happen that you can then experience some awareness?
It's like the scenery changes, so they have to turn off the lights.
Scenery changes, somebody turn off the lights.
I think it's the intensity of it becomes so intense, the whole thing becomes so brittle that it just cracks. Like sometimes Rinpoche would say, make it more. Make it, if you're pissed off, then intensify it. And then it cracks more readily.
I can see how that happens afterward, right? Because you have that contrast, but I'm curious what that... I'm curious about
For me, what it is that once you have some experience of meditation, when you start to do that, when you do that outburst in a really intense way, it like creates this echo. It's like...
So you're watching yourself?
Yes.
Yeah, it sort of deflates on yourself because you start to see yourself doing it, and it becomes hard to keep it together. It's like my
actor.
Right, my attempt to like maintain this intense level of neurosis falters.
Right.
And then that faltering, like as you said, it's like something in the portable stage doesn't work right, you know, like one prop comes in at the wrong time or something, or you know, I just can't maintain it. And any little faltering in that projection then creates an opening that then, if you have the sort of grounding and meditation, it gives you the opportunity to then insert the awareness and then shift it. But when it's just like a lower level of neurosis, I'm very good, and probably we all are, at maintaining it. You know, like, well, this sucks, and you know, she said this, and whatever. But if you really explode it,
right,
it begins to look absurd. It's like, why am I making?
Like a stage set. I mean, like a
It becomes like a theatrical display.
Yeah.
And it's like, oops.
Yeah. Right, it's almost we shock ourselves.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, when you're doing it with somebody else.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
I remember when you described that, I was thinking back to this one experience I remember very vividly. I don't know exactly where we put my daughter and I had gotten into one of our little, you know, things, you know, where it's just, this was in, she's in high school, and there's sort of an intensity of sometimes of just some kind of clash, right? And so it went from, you know, just ordinary, and all of a sudden we were in the middle of this thing.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, and then I remember having this very vivid sense of where did that come from?
Yeah, like this wind just like...
Right, so it was like, first it's this huge thing, we're in this complete tornado, and then suddenly there was just like the eye, or the, let's say, whatever, it's hurricane. So then suddenly it was like the eye of the hurricane. You know, suddenly this slight sense of, where did that come from? Because it was like,
strange.
I know we were, you know, without being analytical, it was just like, before ordinary, suddenly this, and now it's like, what? You know, and you realize the emptiness of the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, right there, that gap. Just to sort of go, I mean, again, not applying all those words at the time, it's just, it's all
quick.
Experiential.
Yeah.
And then you kind of go, oh, that's exactly it.
So then to finish up the second full paragraph, really important description of the watcher, the progression.
It's 151?
151. For the beginner, relating to this awareness may require some level of watching oneself or deliberateness. In the long run, however, watching doesn't come into the picture. So in other places he's talked about this, so we saw in The Profound Treasury, where initially there's the watcher. We develop the watcher in meditation. And it's essential to go through this process of expanding from, or actually achieving the precision of mindfulness, and expanding to that sense of clear comprehension or knowing or awareness in the sense of a larger point of view. But then at some point it has to, the watcher has to drop away, but has to relax that watcher. And that's why he keeps emphasizing so much the going out and the other. Because otherwise one becomes insular and internalized, and it turns into like an absorption experience where one becomes more and more self-aware. So that's that self-awareness that's so key at the beginning of meditation needs to dissolve. Otherwise it becomes like a theistic absorption, fixation type of practice. In the long run, however, watching doesn't come into the picture. For instance, if a chaotic situation happens, there's uncertainty about how to deal with it, and that uncertainty flashes back on us, that uncertainty itself becomes space. In other words, each time there's doubt, the doubt itself brings a kind of bewilderment, but the bewilderment becomes space, spaciousness. So here the obstacles become ways of opening up. Obstacle here described as uncertainty or doubt, the inability to like maintain our usual habitual pattern of knowing what is and what to do. In that way, sort of natural inbuilt understanding of the situation happens. In that sense, there's a shock absorber always present. That kind of awareness is based on a certain amount of trust or optimism. Basically, nothing is regarded as a failure or dangerous. Rather, whatever is experienced is part of a creative and loving relationship toward oneself. The subtle confidence and optimism automatically bring skillful means because we realize there's no need to be panicked. We have a warrior's attitude towards life, which could also be described as faith or belief in our life, or possibly as devotion in our experience in our world. Whatever happens, we always have a fundamental positive quality about our experience of life. Such faith could be said to be the source of an almost magical performance. And he goes on to describe how that confidence has the basis of an approach towards life. Incites what you might call as magical experiences in the sense of things unfolding in a way that our normal contrived approach doesn't usually lead to. And at the end he says, this whole positive flow can only happen if there's no centralized sense of, no centralized security, no sense of need for centralized security. Instead, there's basic faith and belief in one's wholesomeness. Trust that there's an okayness and you don't have to keep track. You don't have to protect it. You don't have to be territorial in one's fundamental healthy situation.
I would like he's pointing to the notion of tendril.
Yeah, I was going to say
that.
I thought he was talking about tendril, about confidence, basic goodness.
Well, no, when he gets into this idea that
auspiciousness.
I feel like it's sort of being able to just allow the, I mean, that's the sort of just arising of whatever, but the ability to have confidence. And that's what, because when he starts talking about the magical aspect, I thought that's sort of what he was in some way alluding to. How do you do it, Dr.?
I thought he was doing a commentary on the three words that point, that strike to the heart.
Seriously? Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The essence of Dzogchen practice, which
yeah.
is really of all Dharma, is that you point out the nature of reality. Samsara, nirvana, whatever. You point out the way that we are confused and the way that we generate our confusion and the way to liberate that and the way that we can lessen our confusion. That's point one. And then point two is you gain confidence in that. There's nothing else you need that other than to know how your mind works, to see the nature of your mind. And then the third point is liberate everything spontaneously by virtue of knowing that is what's happening. That either I can create further neurosis and suffering or I can shift and not hold on, not force, not
control. Basically, the idea there's nothing else.
And that's all there is. You don't need any other elaboration or special this or that. And that's why the confidence is so important. The confidence that all there is that fundamental understanding of the mind is all that we need. That glimpse. Anyway, thank you. By this mirror,
they are all taking omniscience, snake to feed any wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, they have free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Riten's wisdom bloom, may the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled, may all beings enjoy a profound, brilliant glory.